Welcome to Living Healthy Together. Each week we share patient stories, advice and insights from those closest to care, dive into health-related current events, and explore the local and national issues shaping healthcare across our region. I'm your host, Philip Rao, with University of Vermont Health. Our relationship with food is always changing, but one thing that doesn't is its powerful impact on our health and wellness. Whether you're a culinary explorer who loves to try new things, looking to eat healthier to kick off the new year, or searching for ways your family can balance modern lifestyles with healthy eating, we've got a great show for you today. And we'll kick it off by welcoming Leah Pryor, Culinary Medicine Manager at UVM Medical Center, to Living Healthy Together. Leah, thanks for joining us. You're a chef by training, and I'm really excited to have a chance to talk with you about cooking and eating healthy. But first, how does a chef find herself working at an academic medical center? That seems a little unusual.
Well, of course, like everything in chef's life, it's kind of a winding road. The short of it is that I actually had my daughter. This was 15 years ago, and I found myself in an industry that wasn't necessarily forgiving to a new mother. And I decided at that time that I was going to find what my next step was going to be. But I thought it was going to be still in food in the sense of restaurants. But I had a friend who worked here and he said, why don't you go apply at the hospital? And I really kind of felt offended even by him saying I should go into food service. But joke was on me. Because once I reached out and I realized the type of programming that was happening here and the work that's happening in sustainability and nutrition department, that I could really find my home. That was 15 years ago. And I'm still here. And I was really able to create things that kept me engaged, which was the culinary medicine program, working with dietitians and teaching the community and our staff about the importance of food, the joy of cooking, and the science of nutrition. We kind of blended those things together. And here we are. I've now created the next role, which was the culinary medicine manager. So I've been really given an opportunity to engage through food in health with our community, and they love it, and I love it.
What is culinary medicine? This is something you created, you developed at the medical center. What is this approach to food, healthcare, and individuals' health and wellness?
So it is the joy of cooking and married with the science of nutrition with the awe of nature. So when I think of those three components, it is how we connect to the earth in the sense of how our food grows from the soil. That's why we have two beautiful gardens. We have a garden educator, Rachel Boyers. We're really fortunate to be able to do programming in the soil, literally. But then there's also the joy of cooking, meaning the hands-on approach of what being in a kitchen is, how we connect to our kitchens, how we try to bring more foods in, but also just having those kind of, you know, hands-on approach that we might need to feel confident in a kitchen. It's not always easy for people. One of the things I really focus on about culinary medicine and in any of our classes is that cooking is hard. It's not something that's always simple. It takes time, planning, as well as a will to do so. When we tell people, well, you can really help if you were to do dot, 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 it's hard. That's hard. And some people don't even have all the things, all the appliances. They might not have even a stove. So when we are talking about culinary medicine, it really is that tool that helps people kind of find their optimal health with what they have. We meet people where they are. I never show up as a chef. I show up as somebody who really likes to talk about food and wants to have a great time. Culinary medicine is fun. I like to say it is the sugar that makes the medicine go down. People feel safe when there's food. It's interesting. It's just a great tool to connect, to create safe space. And I love doing it.
So there are a ton of different facets to it, not just in terms of what you provide and do, but who you work with as well, right? You work with nutritionists, dietitians, chefs, but you probably work with doctors and nurses too. How far do the tendrils spread?
they spread pretty far, as I like to say. I infiltrate into everything. Mostly when we think about culinary medicine from a clinical perspective, I work very closely with registered dietitians. And through that connection, I'm able to then get into clinical spaces, such as the Comprehensive Pain Program, where we actually have a demo kitchen. Emily Stone, the registered dietitian who works for the Comprehensive Pain Program, she actually does a culinary medicine class that has been happening now since around 2016. Then thinking about Dr. Whitney Culkin's Skills Before Pills, she has been running a shared medical appointment for her patients for, I think, the past 4 years, where she has been able to take culinary medicine, take a dietitian, a chef educator, and a doctor, and actually perform a two-hour class with 12 participants and talking about the pillars of health. And nutrition being a huge part of that, you know, having tastings, of having an experience, also to be able to be with your doctor for 2 hours, amazing. Another area where we have just recently gotten a lot of support is in psychiatry. We have our food and mood program that is with Dr. Kakani, a dietitian, a chef educator, and a garden educator. We were very fortunate to be awarded a foundation grant as well as a bi-state grant where we were piloting this type of food and mood curriculum, which then led us to the Seneca program, where now we're delivering food and mood to many people in Seneca, which actually now will lead us to inpatient psych. So these are really great programs that have been able to grow and really become part of the fabric of patient care. The other area is the Learning Garden, and that's our garden educator, Rachel Boyer's program. We have been running it since, I think, 2013. It's over at Fanny Allen. It is a 20-week program for the novice gardener. And during those 20 weeks, not only are you given a bed where you're able to plant the vegetables and fruits that you enjoy, you're also then given the education from a garden educator, from a registered dietitian to talk about the nutrients and talk about the science of it, as well as a chef educator where you can enjoy the foods that you're growing by doing tastings and demonstrations. So it's a really in-depth 20-week program that has connected to many of our staff. Then we have Gardening for Health, another shared medical appointment where you're in the garden. And that happens on our rooftop here at the hospital. This year, we're actually going to be working with the Cancer Center for a program for survivorship with Gardening for Health. So it's going to be a registered dietitian and Rachel Boyer's together delivering this 6-week program that will take place on our rooftop. Again, as you can see, culinary medicine is not the intervention. It's actually the tool for the clinician to provide the intervention. It is kind of the magic. I've been so fortunate over the years to really see how it has grown and how people really gain trust in healthcare, which sometimes people might not feel necessarily seen. So again, these programs, they're great. We have people who just want more and more. So that's what we're doing.
I'm not sure if you said it directly, but part of what you're talking about here is strengthening people's connection to their food. That's really hard for a lot of folks to wrap their heads around because our relationship to and understanding of food is always changing. What does it mean to be more connected to your food, and what benefits or changes will people see if they take those opportunities?
I think the most important part of that is meeting people where they are. I use the example, if somebody's cutting an onion and I'm there to help guide them, I'm never going to tell them how they're cutting the onion is wrong. Kind of like, if you're buying processed foods, that's not wrong. That is might just be what you have available to you. And to nourish yourself is the most important part. So when we demonize food, sometimes people tend to then say they give up. There's so much food noise in the sense of marketing, in the sense of do this, do that, that people get kind of frozen. So really meeting people where they are is really important. Being able to say, hey, I see that you really like nuts, right? You like peanuts, you like them salted, maybe honeyed. They're delicious. Totally understand. I would love to give you an example of here's a roasted peanut versus a raw peanut. And just having that experience to see what heat does to a peanut could show people like, hey, that's tasty. Just these little micro engagements of having an experience around food can help people start to feel safe in experimenting, because people do not feel safe. They just don't. Whether they have issues with access to food, which is a large problem, which we definitely want to give people who might not feel seen in this space an opportunity to experience. They could also have a lot of different allergies. You know, there are things that a lot of us don't even think about when we're talking about food. So good, bad, and indifferent, right? A lot of people think, oh, food is always good. It's actually not. Some people, you talk about food and it could be very triggering because maybe they don't know where their food is coming from or if they're even going to have enough money to have it. So remembering that it's just taking one step. How can I make people feel safe about talking about their experience around food and moving from there, getting that direct feedback and then saying, hey, let's have this experience together. Let's take a radish. You might not like a radish, but I'm going to roast it. I'm going to toss it in some hoisin, and maybe you like cilantro. I'm going to put that all together and we're going to experience a roasted radish together. You might not like it, but that's okay. You're in a space where you don't have to tell me you like it. You can say, maybe I want it this way, or maybe we can try it with Italian seasonings. Just really thinking about giving the power back.
You talked about safety a couple times there, mentally, but also physically. And I want to reinforce the physical piece because we're still in the time where people are getting together. There's gatherings, whether that's family or friends. Are there things that people should ask or things that they can do in the kitchen when you're preparing meals for a group of people to keep everybody safe and keep everyone healthy?
Something that we do, especially in food services, I like to keep things simple. Meaning if I was going to make a beautiful salad and maybe there's somebody who's lactose intolerant, I keep the cheese on the side. If there is somebody who maybe is a vegan or vegetarian, I would keep the meat as a separate entree, something that can be added to, you know, maybe a casserole that you have. Kind of thinking about your table as varied as possible. Little different dishes that can create one beautiful plate so that people can pick and choose. That usually is a great way to avoid people who might have dietary restrictions in a very safe and easy way. Really, as simple as keeping the blue cheese on the side. It really is as simple as it can get. But the other thing is that if you're doing a potluck or if you're having people who you might already know, is having conversation beforehand. Just say, hey, I know that you have some dietary restrictions. Can you let me know what those are? Do you want to bring a dish that you enjoy so that we can share with everybody? Think about it more in the planning stage. But all in all, if you keep things simple and you keep things that you can build upon, you should be able to feed your guests who are coming in a comfortable and safe way.
We have to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. We'll be right back with more from Chef Leah Pryor, Culinary Medicine Manager at UVM Medical Center. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're here with Chef Leah Pryor, Culinary Medicine Manager at UVM Medical Center, talking about food, the holidays, and her work around a concept called culinary medicine. We're going to get back into the work going on at the medical center shortly, but let's talk a bit more about the star of the show here, food. The holidays are technically over, but there's still a ton going on, treats floating around, traditions and gatherings. What are some of your favorite things to cook and eat this time of year?
I like variation. I like as many things that look beautiful together on a plate. So there could be a beautiful holiday roast, which I'm definitely making. But what I like to do for the sides, I want to make sure there's something crunchy and bright. So I'm going to be making a beautiful kale spinach salad with pomegranates and blue cheese and a little bit of fried shallot with a nice bright champagne vinaigrette, which will be nice, like a nice side to go with that nice piece of meat. I will also have roasted potatoes, But then I like to make sure I also have a lot of roasted vegetables with it. It's all about balance. Listen, there's no good or bad with food. And especially around the holidays, this is a time to celebrate those things. So when you're celebrating, just remember to balance. Make sure that all the things that you like are represented. Make sure that you're eating them how they feel good to you. Tune in, check in. Sometimes we do a little overeating around this time of year because there's just so much deliciousness. Let that happen. That's going to happen. Sometimes by just acknowledging where you are, it can help you in that process of what do you want on your plate. It's not a time to restrict. It's a time to enjoy. There is no silver bullet. I wish I could say, oh yeah, this is what you have to do. This is how your plate needs to look like. Absolutely not. Everybody's looks different. Enjoy the difference, but also be intentional. Be grateful. Share that experience because sometimes it really is about just the happiness it brings. And that can be better medicine than anything else.
What's your favorite part of cooking? Even if it's the tiniest little detail, I love cutting this up or I love the way this smells when it's heating up. What sticks with you and brings you back to the kitchen?
First of all, thank you for making it not what's your favorite dish to cook. You did a beautiful job of avoiding that because that's probably my least favorite question. Oh man, there's so many sensory experiences that I have in a kitchen that bring me back. I think cutting celery is probably one of my most, if you want to talk about ASMR, that's like slicing, pulling the knife through a beautiful stalk of celery is probably one of the most satisfying things that I get to do. Heating up butter and olive oil together, watching them melt, then adding your aromatics and the house filling with those aromas. I can hear my husband down in his office. He'll usually say, it's starting to smell good up there. Those things are truly what bring me back to a kitchen, is just the smells, the experience, the safety that I feel in that space. Being able to create every day something new is the best thing in the world. And that's why I still do it. And I think that's also one of the reasons why I love teaching so much, is because every time I teach, I learn something new. Every time people accept me into their space and we start talking about food, it's amazing what happens. Even if people are having a hard day, or they might not have a great relationship with food, or just life isn't turning out the way they thought, just sitting down and kind of slowing down and backing up and just talking about food together, talking about an experience, sharing those experiences out as a group, it just brings a certain level of joy. I have seen it in so many ways. I've seen people literally drop pain from their shoulder. I see them when they start to connect, when they start to look at me right in the eye, instead of before when I walked in, no, you know, they wouldn't look at me. You know, the smallest of moments for people to just put their pain down, or to put their stress down, or to put the weight down of the world, is kind of amazing. And food does that. Food will do it over and over and over again. It's a magical thing. It's also power. Food is power. And I think sometimes we forget that, because when people don't have access to it, because you can look at it the other side, when people don't have access to food, it's truly a terrible place to be. So, yeah, I love it. I mean, not food insecurity. I don't love that. But I love that I'm able to have connection with people on such a grand scale.
It's so nice to hear someone talk about this with such insight, because a lot of times our relationship with food is so transactional. I need to cook something to feed the kids so they can get to school. But that misses so much about the experience of cooking, eating, or being in the kitchen. When you were talking about your husband and his reaction to smells, my mind went to my 2-year-old, who loves for me to make his mom scrambled eggs, and he wants to crack the eggs. So every morning we crack eggs together. There's a power and connection there that's really fascinating when you think about it.
It allows us to slow down. We think about mindfulness. And again, a word that I find is a little heavy, because who has time to be mindful? Let's be real. It doesn't always look like a yoga mat in a beautiful space with gorgeous windows where we have our eyes closed and everything is perfect. It's actually, mindfulness is these small little things that happen through the day that you notice.
just to slow down. Just because your son says, hey, I want to crack the egg for mom. That's beautiful. That's reminding you, look, I'm showing my son that nourishing his parent is important. That is beautiful. That, to me, is the most mindful thing you could do all day long. Because you're creating a connection. It's around food and it's positive. Well done. Again, mindfulness. If we can kind of redefine what mindfulness is, I think a lot more people would use it as a tool. And that is by just slowing down, breathing, sensing your food, even noticing the colors that are on your plate, smelling them, tasting them, slowing down.
I want to get back to your work at the medical center, in part because the scale of it is so interesting. For years, you managed as an executive chef what is essentially the largest restaurant in the state of Vermont. What was that experience like for you as a chef who had previously run restaurants?
I was the executive chef for 5 years, so executive chef manager. And during that time, I was doing both jobs, so the culinary medicine and the executive chef. But with all of the work that we have done, now I'm actually outside of the kitchen. And now I'm more of a resource or power of one in leadership. The operational part of my job is now gone. So now I'm fully focused on culinary medicine. But my work will be more around creating a new patient menu, around creating a new kind of food scene.
So you're fully focused on the culinary medicine program now, having created this structure and new position. What's next for you and culinary medicine at UVM Medical Center?
Our goal is that we're going to create an experiential curriculum around culinary medicine that can plug and play into any disease state. Because, like I said, culinary medicine is a tool. It can fit anything. It just needs to be curated for the crowd that it's providing, you know, information for. So I see this as the way of getting into a system that can then get throughout the whole state of Vermont to really create the first food is medicine roadmap, which will then lead to us hopefully continuing to work on policy to get a waiver, which is called the 1115 waiver, that can then help providers bill for this type of experiential learning. My job for the next 3 years is to make culinary medicine as accessible as possible for as many people throughout the state of Vermont.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation around food, health, and wellness with registered dietitians who specialize in lifestyle medicine, pediatric weight management, and diabetes, and get their insight on food, fad diets, and maybe even some high-value tips and tricks for those of us struggling with young and picky eaters. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're diving into the impact and importance of food on our health and wellness, as well as tips and tricks for making healthy, sustainable food choices as we kick off 2026. We're joined now by Melissa Kelly, a registered dietitian nutritionist at UVM Medical Center, who's board certified in lifestyle medicine. Melissa, thanks for joining us. That's a lot to digest right there in terms of what you do and the insight you bring to the table. What drew you to this work and what is the work that you focus on?
So a registered dietitian, honestly, there's a bunch of different things that we do. When I was in undergrad, I didn't even know what a dietitian was. I went into college for chemical engineering and I quickly realized that it wasn't for me. And my advisor at the time was like, oh, well, like, what do you like doing? And I was like, well, I like working out. I like cooking. I like being healthy, I guess. And she's like, well, what about a dietitian? And when I looked into it, I was like, wow, this is actually like really amazing. This is what I would want to do. It basically is just like the study of nutrition and how to benefit and promote health and wellness in people's lives. And there's so many different areas where dietitians can work. We can work in the clinical setting. We can work in the outpatient setting. We can work in sports nutrition. We can work in nursing homes. If you can think of a corporation, there's likely a dietitian on board there. You know, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, all of these places have dietitians on board. So really, like, the opportunities are endless. Lifestyle medicine focuses on 6 pillars, and it's basically taking, it takes a preventative approach. But also, if you have lifestyle diseases, you can also be on medication and be working towards veterinary health. But it focuses on 6 pillars. It focuses on nutrition or diet. It focuses on exercise, sleep health, stress, avoidance of risky substance, and then exercise. So it looks at these 6 pillars and it optimizes basically people's health to prevent lifestyle diseases. It takes a whole food plant-based approach. So they're really emphasizing plant-based diets or plant-forward diets, as well as meeting our physical activity guidelines and avoidance of risky substances, just to live as healthfully for as long as we can. It's about optimizing our health span. There's our lifespan and there's our health span. Lifespan is how long we live for, and health span is how long we live healthfully for. So it's about optimizing that health span to live as healthfully as long as we can.
This is the time of year when people are really thinking a lot about making changes, trying to be healthier, trying to be the best version of themselves. Where does diet fit into that for you? Is it one of those, you can't get there from here without diet?
I definitely think that it's a very loaded question. Healthy means something different to everybody. And while I'm certified in lifestyle medicine, I do take a very individualized approach based on where individuals are coming from. Speaking specifically to the new year, I feel like there's a lot of stress for people to feel like new year, new me, having to do all these cleanses and these resets to really optimize whatever health even means. And honestly, like, I think a lot of these fad diets or these trends that people tend to adopt in the new year, I think that those are the opposite of health, because that's not something that you can do long term. It's something that people are typically coming from a place of guilt or shame from overeating on the holidays or not eating as healthfully as you think you can. So it's not always from the most positive mindset, which isn't what I like to guide people to do. I like people to come from a place of abundance, because that's what's going to create change. That's what's going to create habits that actually stick. So when the new year comes around, I always recommend people to give yourself some grace and don't try and do the most extreme thing, which people tend to like to live in extremes. It's either black or white. There's no gray. And we need to live in that gray area, especially when it comes to diet and exercise. So it's all about, like, taking where you are at now and applying some of these core concepts of how can you change what you're doing now to maybe inch closer to a quote-unquote more healthy lifestyle. Somebody's diet, for example, and the recommendations are between 5 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. And say that's the new year coming and you're like, I'm going to eat a healthy diet. I'm going to eat 5 to 8 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. And if you're coming from somewhere where maybe you're not even eating fruit and vegetable every day, or maybe you're eating 1 serving, that's a big jump for somebody to make. And maybe in the beginning, you can sustain it. But once that initial motivation and dopamine wears off, it's not going to be sustainable. So you want to start somewhere more realistically for you. So if the goal is 5 to 8 servings and you're eating 1 or 2 servings, maybe make it, I'm going to eat 3 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Make it something that's going to be achievable and sustainable for you. This is where the concept of SMART goals come. They are really, really so helpful for people. A SMART goal is a specific, measurable, actionable, realistic, and time-bound goal. That way, instead of giving yourself just the broad goal of, I want to be healthier, dig deeper in what does healthier look like for you. It's going to be something that's realistic for where you are. Maybe it's just trying to get some fruit and vegetable into your day to get a little bit of a more balanced diet. I think there's a lot of stress at the beginning of the year and New Year's resolutions come, but I think it's like 96% of people like fall off of their New Year's resolutions by like the second week of January. So you don't want to create something too crazy or too rigid for yourself, because then that's going to create another cycle of shame and guilt for not being able to fulfill these unrealistic goals that you set for yourself.
That seems like a really common pitfall almost everybody faces. Are there other challenges specific to our region when people are thinking about incorporating more nutritious food into their diet?
I think one of the most common is going to be access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And we do have access to them, but it's more like farmers markets in the summer are plentiful here, and there's fresh strawberries, fresh raspberries, fresh blueberries. You can go right down the road and pick them at your local stand or whatever, and there's all these wonderful green veggies. But in the winter time, it's mostly those root vegetables, more starchy vegetables, not as many fresh fruits. So I think that that's definitely a common challenge that people will face. And that's a great opportunity to explore some of the seasonality that we're provided with. Winter is a perfect example of that's when our citrus is in its peak and its prime season. It's kind of beautiful that Mother Nature is like, oh, you know, we definitely need some more vitamin C. Citrus is in season now. And going to the store, and there's always so many different kinds of citrus fruit. So there's, you know, sumo oranges, tangerines, mandarins, and just exploring and playing around with what's in the grocery store. Often what's in season is what's going to be on sale at the grocery store. So looking at your weekly flyers and seeing what there is. Kiwis are another great source of vitamin C. Pomegranates are another great winter fruit. So just being more adventurous with your fruits and vegetables, and same with your greens like kale and Swiss chard. They're more of those winter veggies. There's so many different varieties, and exploring that way. And I do think it's a wonderful thing too, if you have access to it, joining a local CSA, because it's kind of like Christmas every week. You don't really know what you're going to get, and it's a great way to try something you typically would maybe pick up at the grocery store for yourself. Another really big challenge in the winter time is physical activity and exercise. It gets really cold out there. It gets really windy. And so the motivation to want to go outside and go for a walk or go for a run, maybe I'm just speaking for myself, but it's not something I really enjoy. I think that's another place where exploring forms of movement is really great. Explore your local indoor pool, or explore maybe some cycling classes, or maybe some YouTube videos. There's so many different YouTube videos, strength training, yoga videos, Pilates videos, just to get some movement in throughout the day to try and help meet those guidelines of 150 minutes of physical activity a week. The cold can be a barrier for wanting to do things, and same with the sun setting so early. We kind of want to hibernate and go in our shell, but we also still want to make sure that we're getting in some physical activity.
Let's talk about whole foods versus processed or prepackaged foods for a second. Is it challenging to transition to a more whole foods-based diet from one that relies heavily on processed or prepackaged foods? And are there any tips or tricks for folks who are trying to make that leap?
I definitely think there is a big challenge, and that's for a multitude of reasons. The biggest one would be our taste buds kind of get used to how much sugar and salt that we're consuming, and our processed foods or our ultra-processed foods are a lot higher in salt and sugar because it excites our taste buds. It makes us want to eat more. It gives us a dopamine hit, so we keep going back for it. So when we transition from a Dorito to a carrot, we're like, what the heck? I'm not getting that dopamine hit. After a while, your body gets tired of chewing the carrot, whereas the Dorito, there's a whole jobs for food scientists to create that perfect bite, and it's different each time. So no bite is just like the last one. So it makes you want to keep going back for more. And there's nothing wrong with Doritos, but we also want to make sure that we are incorporating some more or less processed foods, so we're not missing out on those micronutrients and dietary fiber that we need to for health. Another big area that's hard for people when switching from processed or ultra processed to more whole foods is the convenience factor. You know, cooking is hard. Preparing food for yourself is hard. Whereas if you're getting something for convenience, you don't really have to think about it too much. So finding ways that will make it easier for yourself. Say you're having, you can do that frozen dinner, that's totally fine, but can you add something to it? Can you add a serving of frozen veggies to it? Can you add maybe a little side salad just to get some non-starchy vegetables in there, just to get a little bit more fiber? I'm really big on what can people add into their diet versus what can you take out of your diet. So if somebody is coming from a place where they're eating mostly ultra-processed foods or processed foods, what can you add into your diet to help us get a little bit more nutrition in there, to make it a little bit more of a healthful diet? Maybe it's adding a fourth of a cup of some beans to whatever frozen meal you're getting, or a serving of non-starchy vegetables or frozen veggies to your meal to get some more of that great fiber. I think that that's a great place to start. And over time, your taste buds will get used to not consuming as much sugar and as much salt. So a blueberry will start to taste sweeter to you. You'll start to taste the natural sweetness in carrots. That's the biggest problem with processed food or ultra processed food. It kind of hijacks our taste buds and makes whole foods not taste as good. And that's the flavor scientist creating that bliss point of salt, sugar, and fat to make us continue to eat them, not be as satisfied with carrots or blueberries.
We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where we're talking food, health, and wellness to kick off 2026. We're joined now by Allison Precourt, a registered and certified dietitian and a certified diabetes educator whose main focus is pediatric diabetes and weight management. Allison, thanks for joining us today. You've been working in these fields for more than 40 years, so you've seen our understanding of nutrition and diet change. You've seen our approach to dietary health and wellness shift based on research and new information and understandings. What are some of the biggest, most important changes you've seen over the course of your career?
In my 40-some-odd years working as a professional, primarily at UVM Medical Center, I have seen a lot of change. And nutrition science, as in other science, is an evolving science. It's an evolving area. So what we did and what we knew 30 years ago certainly has changed. In the world of nutrition, we went from this low-fat craze in the 80s and 90s to, gee, the healthy stuff, the healthier fats, not necessarily low-fat. I think what's really stuck with me and what has come through over the decades, though, has been the solidarity of the importance of healthy eating. And that really hasn't changed. So with all the fad diets that come and go and all the fad foods that come and go, we really go back to wholesome eating, healthy eating, eating foods that look like what they're supposed to in their more original form. We had processed foods, now we have ultra processed foods. But again, we go back to the simple things. Eat right, get outside, move around, get some fresh air. And I think we go full circle with some of these items.
It feels like there's this very strong public narrative that pediatric obesity and weight-related issues have been on this consistent ramp up over decades. And there are various things that people point to as the reason behind that. Can you ground us a little bit? Is this public narrative accurate?
Just as in the adult world, the prevalence of obesity has just skyrocketed over the past 30 years, the same thing in the pediatric world. So we have an increase in the number of not just teenagers, but preteens and toddlers moving into that realm, the definition of pediatric obesity, which is based on a percentile of your BMI. And it's a very complex issue. Again, just like adults, it's not just the food. There can be a lot of reasons. You look at communities that don't have sidewalks. So people that are in neighborhoods that aren't really safe, that their children aren't outside playing. That's a part of it. You look at supermarket deserts and food deserts. So areas that don't have good quality basic healthy eating. So they might have gas station foods or these tiny, small
grocery stores that those people can charge whatever they want. Because if you're in a poor community, you can't afford to get into a car and to drive to some of the places that have the less expensive items. It's also wrapped into politics. So you think about the nutrition food, the lunch program that has changed over the years and what was defined as a vegetable and who qualifies for school lunch. Currently in Vermont, at least, all students in schools can get breakfast, they can get school lunch. So there isn't any stigmatism about, gee, you can't afford to get the school programs. There's been lots of different movements in that area, but it's a really, really complex situation. I think that COVID was just another level in this complexity. During the pandemic, what do we tell people? Go inside. Go inside. Don't go outside. Eat comfort food. It's a really stressful time. So the incidence of obesity, especially in those higher-risk kids that were in the higher percentiles, that went up even worse than some of the other groups. So it's an answer that's not easily provided, and it really involves lots and lots of different layers. But to that extent, there's lots of areas that we can make an impact, and we can make some policy changes, let's say, or include the schools in changes, not just the pediatricians, not just the parents. It's really a community of people coming together to address pediatric overweight and obesity.
It's really easy to think about weight-related issues and being overweight as a completely self-contained problem. It's because of what you're eating or what you're doing and not doing. And that has a place in the equation, but like you said, there are all of these things that people can't control. A five-year-old can't control whether they can walk to a park and play, or whether they have a front yard, or whether their parents can get to a grocery store. What are things that families can do to help their kids, whatever age they are?
We start with, what are parents doing themselves? Modeling. Kids are really great. Our kids are minor birds. They will model the behavior that they see. So if parents are eating healthy, or if they're in a journey of trying to increase their fruits and vegetables, or less fast food, less food outside the home, then the kids can embrace that. That's the first part, is parents really have to model the behavior. Another one is looking at, where is the food coming from? How many players are involved? Looking at the school menu. Is your child having breakfast at home and then going and having breakfast at school? And that might be too many breakfasts for a child. What is the school offering? What about the after-school programs? What are the snacks that are offered? So the more people that are offering different kinds of foods, or grandparents even, caregivers, the less that family has control. So one of the things that I encourage is taking a look at that. And are there ways where you can really focus on your kids getting foods that you've made, that are safe foods, that are healthy foods, that are foods that you have control over?
Are there strategies for younger kids that you recommend or that really work well if folks are struggling, whether it's eating at all or eating the right stuff?
It really starts with birth. Actually, before birth, there's a lot of interesting research saying that what the mother eats, those children may adapt and like some of those foods. So during pregnancy, healthy eating stuff. And then that the child is born, and whether you are breastfeeding or you're bottle feeding, really establishing a good, safe, kind environment, taking cues from the child. And that evolves as they become more independent eaters. So at some point in that first year, they're going to try solid foods. And that's really good practice in managing their dexterity, taking foods and with their pinchers and putting in their mouth. That's practicing for better eating later on. That's practicing for using utensils, encouraging them, allowing them, understanding that messy eating is part of it. But kids learn to put things in their mouth, they're going to get messy, and that's okay. A lot of people, they're wiping their face off and things. It's okay. Just relax. And then into the early toddler years, they do become very independent. And so this is a really good time to establish, what's your role? What's the role of the parent and what's the role of the child? And the role of the parent is to decide the menu, to buy the food, to make the food. And that's where it stops. And then the role of the child is whether they're going to eat it or not. The child either will eat or they won't eat. And nobody eats a nice meal or snack every single meal, right? So the idea that you are offering some healthy things, some fruit, some vegetables in there, some good protein, some higher fiber starches in portions that are appropriate for them, and then just allow them to eat it without the pressure of, as they become older and more verbal, I don't want this, I want chicken nuggets. No child comes into this world wanting chicken nuggets or the sugar cereals, the Captain Crunch, the Apple Jacks. That's learned behavior. And it's very easy to go down that path of, oh, I want them to eat, so I'm going to give them what they want. If you are comfortable and confident in what you're offering, what you're serving, your child's going to pick up on that. And if they're participating in the meal together, toddlers should have their feet supported. So that's the other part to think about is, are their feet dangling? Think about a bar stool that's a good 2 or 3 feet off the ground. If you sit on that bar stool, you have to sit up quite straight and using your abdominal muscles so you don't fall back. Boy, that takes a lot of activity, a lot of muscle tone to sit in that chair. So think of a child being in a chair where his feet are dangling or there's no back part. He's going to focus on just being comfortable. He might even sit on his legs. A lot of people are using adult chairs for kids because that's what the child wants. But they spend the whole time wiggling. They're sitting on their feet and they just disregard the fact that there's food there. So making your child comfortable, making sure that they're seated in a chair that's appropriate, that their feet are supported, their back is supported, and that the table should come about belly button level so that at least they're comfortable. Now, that doesn't guarantee that they're going to eat really well, but at least it gives you a start. Giving kids the comfort, the security that they're not going to starve, that this is the meal. And if you choose not to eat, that's okay. We're not going to pressure you to eat. But tell us about your day. What was the best part of your day? What was the worst part of your day? And starting those conversations at mealtime, because those conversations early on move into other conversations later on as preteens, as teenagers. And there's this open safe space for them to talk about what might be going on. So again, food and bringing people to the table has lots of importance for younger kids and for families. And it really is one of the pillars of good nutrition.
There's so much more to talk about here. What are some new and developing things in the world of pediatric nutrition that have the potential to make a really big positive impact for kids and families?
Here's a number of things. I think in the pediatric world, we're on board with bringing communities together to really help kids be the best version of themselves, to grow up and develop to be the best that it can be. And to that effect, there's a lot of people that are working on healthy eating, making labels a little more understandable, working on places that are safe for them to get good physical activity. Kids need an hour a day of good outside activity, being able to play. So there are people, there are communities coming together to help. That leap is a really important part of a child's world for their growth and development. For weight control, as with adults, we know that poor sleep, disruptive sleep can add to weight gain and a lot of other things. There's a lot of information, good science that's coming out to support some of these pillars, some of these habits that we've known about that are important to help our kids grow. Coming together for healthy eating, I think the schools are helping to do it. I think the American of Pediatrics is also helping. Certainly my own organization, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. I think that a lot of people are coming together to try to address the obesity problem in the world of kids and adults, but tackle it on a number of different levels. So I'm really excited. There's some medications that are out there too. That's a whole nother discussion about weight loss medications in kids, but you really need those building blocks before in. They really need to know how to eat healthy. They need to be able to get outside. They need to have good sleep and being careful of their sedentary screen time activities. I'm excited that those are things that I think parents can start to work on and change and affect good behavior change.
That's all the time we have today on Living Healthy Together. Thanks to all our guests for being with us and sharing their stories and insights. If you're out there listening and have a question, comment, or idea for a future episode, email us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org. Living Healthy Together is also available as a podcast. If you're interested in checking out some of our past episodes, look us up wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to follow, subscribe, and consider giving us that 5-star rating, which really helps a lot. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.